Venerable Lumpo Anan has invited me to share some Dhamma with you. I believe this is the last day of your online retreat, so I rejoice in your practice. Sadhu Anamotana. I was recently in India for 7 weeks, practicing at holy sites and leading quite a large group, 70 people. I've just been back for a couple of days, and on one level, I'm inspired. On one level, I feel energized. And on another level, I'm also exhausted. So I'm not completely sure how lucid this talk will be, but I will do my best to try to share something that will hopefully be relevant. I also have someone who has to speak in public nightmare. I woke up with a pimple on my nose. Anyway, I will try to overlook it. Please have compassion for me. So I'll probably try to weave in a few threads of our spiritual journey, which is both outward and inward, which is present moment but ongoing. When I was a very junior monk at Wat Pa Nanachat, had a lot of doubts and a lot of restlessness and a lot of qualities that young monks have. And I once said to Ajahn Jayasaro, I believe I was, I would have been two punters, I think. I said to Thanh Ajahn Jayasaro, who was the abbot at the time, Ajahn Kap, I think you should lead a pilgrimage to the four holy sites of India, and you should take a few monks with you, because if we increased our merits and our faith, that would increase our chances of staying as a monk for a long time. So the following year, Ajahn Jayasaro accepted an invitation to lead a pilgrimage to India. And he invited five monks to come with him, and I was not one of them. And I had some hurt feelings, and I said to him, Ajahn Jaya, I suggested the idea. I want to go. Why didn't you invite me? And he said, I have no doubt, Tanachalo, in the future, when you're a well-respected monk, you will be invited to India many times. Now the problem was, when I was three punters, I couldn't actually imagine making it to five punters, and I couldn't imagine being a well-respected monk, and I couldn't imagine anybody inviting me to India, so I wasn't convinced. But I did have the quality of faith, and after my fifth rainy season retreat, I went on a tudong, wandering from Wat Nanachat to Pratat Phanom Chedi, and then to Sakon Nakhon. I wanted to pay respects to relics of Lumpur Man, and I wanted to, because our life is more comfortable than the Kruba Ajahn's of Lumpur Man, Lumpur Cha's day, I wanted to do what we call a patipati puja, an offering of practice, of undertaking some of the dutanga practices of not accepting rides, sleeping in open fields, sleeping in charnel grounds, and that kind of thing. So I walked about, I guess it's about 300 kilometers to Tat Phanom and Sakon Nakhon. I noticed that when I meditated at Pratat Phanom Chedi, which is believed to have a genuine Buddha relic, that my mind became quite peaceful, even though I'd walked 20 kilometers. It was the end of the day, and I sat down and I noticed that the mind became more peaceful, even though it was noisy and even though I was tired, and I made a note of that. That's an interesting occurrence. And then, unfortunately, I got some stomach upset. So I ended up taking a bus. I was originally going to walk all the way to Chiang Mai, but I rested for a couple of days, took some medicine, and accepted a bus ticket from Sakhon Nakhon to Uttaradit. And then I decided to walk along the train tracks from Uttaradit to Chiang Mai. Again, I think that was about another 250 kilometers. In a place called Mae Rim, north of Chiang Mai, there is a very interesting holy site. It's called Prabuddhaba Siloy, the four Buddha's footprints. And it's the only place in the world where there's a believed to be an impression made by the four Buddhas that have come into this world, this eon. So that is Kakusanda, Konagamana, Kassapa, and Gautama Buddha. And it's believed that Maitreya will also leave his imprint on that place. So I was thinking at the time, well, I can't go to the four holy sites in India yet, but I can go and pay respects to the four Buddha's footprints in Mae Rim. And I noticed something when I was walking on the train tracks. I'd been sick and sunburned and blistered and sore feet and, you know, sore shoulders. And, you know, Thailand is not what it was in Lumpur Mun and Lumpur Cha's day. It's largely deforested now, and there tends to be some litter, and you're in the full sun when you walk. So it was a bit depressing in some respects. And even so, I was happy to do it as a gesture of puja to the Krubra Ajahns. I noticed that when I was just saying Butto, Butto, the mind didn't become bright, it wasn't glad. But when I looked at these train tracks, I had an intuition one day, because I was going to the four Buddha's footprints, and then I was thinking of the past lives of the Buddhas that lent to their Buddhahood and the sacrifice that they'd made. And I decided to recite their names, make it a bit more personal as I walked along those tracks. Namo Kakusando Butto, Namo Konagamano Butto, Namo Kassapa Butto, Namo Gautama Butto, Namo Maitreya Butto. And my mind became very peaceful and very rapturous. And one of the things that we do in the forest tradition is we have a five-year training period where we train under our teachers. And then after those 5 years, we are allowed to explore other practices, other places, be a little bit more independent. In consultation with our teachers, of course, but it's a time to just spread your wings a little and get out there and learn about yourself outside of your training monastery. And so I learned at that time that faith was something that possibly I had a natural proclivity towards, that if I brought my faith and gratitude to the Buddhas to mind, the mind became happy. And it was kind of a beautiful vision. You saw all of these railway sleepers, I think hundreds of thousands of lives that the Bodhisatta spent cultivating qualities, accumulating merit to be a Buddha so that he could have his insight, set the wheel of Dharma rolling and teach us. And so the meditation could go in several directions. It could just be kind of like an awe of the sacrifice, the focus, the determination of the parami of the Buddhas. It could also be gratitude, how wonderful that there are beings that did that for us. It could also be when you're feeling tired and sore and you don't have the energy, recollecting the energy that these practitioners put forth, and it energizes the mind. And once again, I meditated by a stupa, a chedi, in Lampang, Lampun, Pratat Hari Punchai, and at the time I had a chest infection, and sore muscles, etc. And once again, my mind became quite peaceful, and I noticed that this is really interesting. And there's believed to be a relic, a genuine Buddha relic inside that stupa. It's one of the oldest in Thailand. And when I was passing through Chiang Mai, I walked up to Doi Su Thep and meditated by that chedi. And similarly, the mind became more peaceful and normal. When I finally made it to the Four Buddha's footprints, I made the aspirational prayer. Due to this merit, may I receive an invitation to the four holy sites in India. So, and 2 days later, I did. So there was a lady, a Thai lady, who was a university professor in Washington State. And I'd stayed in her house in Chiang Mai. It was empty at the time, upstairs, and she came to offer the meal. Well, she stayed somewhere else and allowed me to stay there. And she came and offered the meal, and she asked me, I don't understand. You live in a good monastery with good standards, with good monks, with good teachers. Everything's there for you to meditate a lot. What are you doing wandering around getting blistered feet, sunburn, cold sores, chest infections, food poisoning? What are you doing? And I'm like, well, I want to acknowledge the hardships of the previous generations and make a gesture of puja, an offering of practice and gratitude and respect towards that. And so then I walked and continued to the Four Buddha's footprints, and I came back down and I stayed at that place yet again, and she came with some friends and offered food, and then she said, you know, what you said the other day reminded me of something. It reminded me that I've been wanting to go to the four holy sites in India for many years, and I'd forgotten. What you're doing is a pilgrimage. I want to do a pilgrimage. And then she asked, if I were to go on that pilgrimage, would you come, Tanachalo? And I modestly said, yes, if you invite me, I will come. Thank you. And so there's a few points to the story I just told. One is, if someone else doesn't fulfill your dreams for you, don't give up. Make a good, honest, hard effort, and make some effort towards fulfilling your own dreams and aspirations. It's not really beneficial to sit around sulking and feeling sorry for ourselves. We have to make an effort, do something to help ourselves, produce our own merit. And then, so it was 2 years later, after Ajahn Jayasoro took his group on the pilgrimage, but I was invited on the pilgrimage. And since then, I've been to India 19 times. And so devotional practice and pilgrimage is a large part of my life. A lot of people won't know this because Tanajana Nan has not been to India, I think, for 9 years now, as he has aged, as we all are. The likelihood of chest infections, sinus infections, stomach upsets, not very clean air, it affects the body more as we age. And when you're younger, you have more robust health and high functioning immune systems. You can roll with the punches, as it were. But Tanajan stopped going to India about 9 years ago. But I used to ask him. I asked him because he used to come back. I think he went more than 10, somewhere between 10 and 20 times. And I asked him, because every time he came back, he'd have a sinus infection or a dry cough, and it would last for a month or 6 weeks. And I would ask him, Tanajan, why do you keep going? You've done this pilgrimage many times. Why do you keep going back to India? And he said, well, I'm not going for myself. He said, I've noticed that when my students go and pay respects at those holy sites, they come back and they're more determined in their practice. They're more focused in their practice. They're more resolute. Because the particular merit that comes from pilgrimage is merit that supports the spiritual practice. It's merit that is conducive towards practicing towards liberation. Lord Buddha said in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, when he was talking to Ananda, that those with faith in him, once he has attained Nibbana without remainder, attained to the deathless, those who want to show their respects for him should go to these four holy sites. And Tanajan Ananda said, see, I have to be a bit careful what I tell you about what Ajahn Ananda says, you see. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to, because Ajahn Ananda has said a lot of things to me. I'm a close disciple of Ajahn Ananda. but so I don't know what was meant to be discreet or between he and I. So what I'm going to try to do is I'll keep it to things that I've heard Thanh Ajahn say in his own public Dhamma talks. So I have heard Thanh Ajahn say in his own talks in Thai that when his disciples paid respects in Bodh Gaya, that he saw a stairway to heaven manifest above their heads and the gates of heaven literally opened. So when Lord Buddha makes a statement that going on pilgrimage produces powerful, potent merit conducive to one's well-being for a long, long, long time and conducive to heavenly rebirth, Lumpur Anan also said that he literally saw, with his more subtle eye faculty, a stairway to heaven manifest above his students' heads. Now, we understand that the heavens are made of a more subtle form, and heavenly rebirth is attained through accumulation of merit. So when one accumulates potent merit, things happen in the more subtle realms. Thanh Ajahn Ananda also did say that the practitioner must actually still walk in a way that they have to ascend the stairway to heaven. Lord Buddha describes his teachings as leading to heaven and beyond. So people aspire for liberation, for nirvana, to attain the deathless. But we must do good, avoid harm, and purify the mind. In the process of doing good, we produce merit. In the process of avoiding harm, we avoid demerit. When we produce merit, the likelihood of heavenly rebirth increases. So Thanh Ajahn would take his students there because he saw that when they came back, they were more diligent. One of the reasons I went on this most recent practice is I'm working on fulfilling a personal vow. I'm trying to meditate, do a practice puja of 5,000 hours of meditation under the Bodhi tree. And I so far done about 4,400. And being mindful that I have been supported many times, for me it's a matter of ethics, a matter of morality. I feel that if any person has a lot of any one resource, they should be involved in sharing that resource and making it available to other people. So since I was have been supported to practice in holy sites and go on pilgrimage, I felt it appropriate to make the opportunity available to others. And so I did take 9 other monks, 2 nuns, 58 lay people, 2 buses to... Last year we went to Bodh Gaya, the place of the enlightenment, Sarnath, the place of the setting in motion, the wheel of Dhamma, and Vulture's Peak, Veluvana, in Rajgir. This year we went to Sawati, the site of the Jetavana, Kusinara, the site of the Mahaparinibbana, and Lumbiniwana, the site of the birth. I'm mindful, of course, that I'll say a little bit about that. What's very interesting about paying respects in the holy sites is, suppose you're meditating at Bodh Gaya, and suppose there's a large gathering of Chinese monks and they're chanting loudly their puja. Suppose next to them there is a Vietnamese group who are chanting loudly their puja, which is also amplified. And suppose behind you there is a large Bhutanese group who are chanting their puja, largely amplified. And then suppose you have a couple of hundred Sri Lankans marching behind you doing their puja, and you're sitting under the meditation, under the Bodhi tree, trying to meditate, and you're listening to 4 simultaneous loud pujas in 4 different languages, which is often the case these days. What's very interesting is it is still possible for the mind to become peaceful. And many people who go on pilgrimage and pay respects and practice then notice this, that okay, just go through the motions, set one's mindfulness before one, as Lord Buddha says to do, in the Anapanasati, set the intention. Anapanasati is to set the attention, to be aware of the breath, give the interest to the breath, note hearing, as Lompo Cha says, try not to disturb the noise, it's not the noise disturbing, and just incline the mind inwards. And most people find that despite the raucous noise and movement and unpredictability of the place, the mind can experience some quite deep peace and serenity and clarity. And this is very instructive for people, because when a feeling of a self-struggling, irritated, reactive falls away and the mind is with the breath consistently and the noise is still there but the mind isn't annoyed, it suggests something very strong to oneself. When there's aches in the body and just a moment ago you were struggling with, oh, this is too hard, I can't do this, oh, it hurts too much, I need to get up, but you don't get up and you continue meditating, and once again the mind becomes content to be with the awareness that knows feelings as feelings, and the irritation falls away and a sense of tranquility becomes very palpable in the mind, then one notices, oh, it's not the case that when there are aches and pains I have to get up. It's not the case that when there's noises I can't meditate. It's not the case that when it's too hot, too cold, too hungry, too noisy, too crowded, too dirty, too busy, whatever it is. It's not the case that we can't meditate, actually. If we are diligent and consistent in being with our meditation object, which many of you have been doing in this retreat period, then it's that consistency, when you look at the five spiritual powers, it's that consistency of effort produces energy. Putting the, with faith, consistency of effort with faith in your potential, in Ajahn Anand's abilities as a teacher, in the suitability of his teachings, in Lord Buddha's enlightenment. And then you keep putting your effort into being consistently mindful of your meditation object. And then some collectedness occurs. Lumpur Anand talks about Kanika Samadhi, Upajara Samadhi, when the mind is peaceful for 5 minutes, and as we progress, the mind might become more peaceful, 15, 20 minutes. In one sit, there might be several periods of 5 or 10 minutes that are peaceful. In one session in the day, there might be 20, 30, 40 minutes which are peaceful. Some of those sessions when the mind is getting more better mindfulness and more samadhi because of consistency and diligence. And then that's what gives us a stable foundation to have the insights into impermanence, into not self. So I have one student in Bangkok who, very busy lady, successful lady, but busy lady, who came to meditate for 5 days, and I've encouraged her. I told her that she has to increase her sitting in her practice in Bodh Gaya by 1 hour every time she comes. And she's up to 8 hours now. She has to sit for 8 hours. And she noticed that on the second or third day that there was just awareness of breath, no feeling of being a self, awareness of noise, but the noise not irritating her. A feeling of coolness, stillness, fullness, and no sense of being a self. And she explained to me afterwards her experience, and I asked her questions, was it like this, was it like this, was it like this? Yes, yes, yes. And then she said she finally understood when the monks talk about emptiness, the lack of solidity, lack of permanence, and not self. It's because the teachings, the concepts, the words that the monks and nuns use, the Buddha uses, is like a map. But the map isn't the destination. The destination is an inner experience occurring in the mind. And so we can spend a lot of time reading maps. We can argue about which map we think is more correct. We can compare maps. You're still not at the destination. The point of the descriptions and the instructions is to keep practicing until one has insight, until one experiences samadhi, and then you know what it's like for a cool and collected mind. Then you know you have the potential to have a cool and collected mind. If you are consistent in your mindfulness and you don't give up on your efforts, you'll notice that the self-view that grasps at my body, my thoughts, my future, my past, my friends, my enemies, my plans, when that goes away for a period of time because you've been consistently mindful of a wholesome meditation object, you haven't been feeding the ignorance, you haven't been feeding the self-view, when that falls away and there's just the mindfulness of the breath, or there's just the being content with being with the awareness that knows these things as not self, not I, thoughts as thoughts, you'll notice that when there isn't a strong sense of self there's nothing there to suffer, so there isn't suffering. And that's what our practice leads to, and that's what our practice points to. That when we look at the First Noble Truth, the various ways that we suffer because of grasping, when we have a look at that grasping and we ask ourselves, well, can I let go of it? Can I just keep practicing even though I want to get up? Can I keep practicing even though I want to sleep? Don't follow the craving for and craving not for. Follow the Eightfold Path. Be consistently mindful with the meditation object. And then you will have these experiences, because when you are consistently mindful, it's the opposite of ignorance and delusion. When you keep establishing clarity, that's the opposite of the darkness of delusion and ignorance. Lord Buddha said, after his experience at the Bodhi tree, in the several weeks that he spent meditating under the Bodhi tree and in the vicinity, he was somewhat in awe of his own experience of liberation. And he was looking back, how is it possible to have realized the deathless after all of these billions of lives bound by birth, aging, and death? And he saw that previous list I was talking about, the five spiritual powers, when cultivated, made much of, lead to the deathless and merge in the deathless. Deathless meaning Nibbana. But on a subsequent week, his insight was these four foundations of mindfulness, when cultivated, made much of, lead to the deathless and merge in the deathless. So all of this effort that you're making, sitting, walking, to be mindful of the body's postures, to be mindful of breath meditation, mindful of feelings that arise due to body-based contact, aware of feelings as feelings, the body as the body, thoughts as thoughts, the emotions under them, the mind states, and aware of their nature, arising, staying for some time, ceasing, arising, staying for some time, ceasing. It's really helpful and important if we have faith in this, because it's leading to something so profound you can't really even imagine it, because it's beyond concepts. But when the Buddha makes these profound statements, this mindfulness, when cultivated, leads to the deathless and merges in the deathless. That is something to take great confidence in. Many years ago, Lumpur Nan was answering questions of a visiting bhikkhuni, a student of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Lumpur Nan was describing how he feels is the best way to develop the four foundations of mindfulness. And he said, at first, we have to make the body awareness, consistent mindfulness of the body, our foundation. So we cultivate awareness while walking of the feelings and the footsteps. We know when we're walking, we know when we're passing through a door, we know when we're eating, we know when we're lying down, we know we're going to the bathroom, all of those things. And then when sitting, we refine the mindfulness to be aware of the in-breath, aware of the out-breath, But what happens is when you have your consistent mindfulness based in the awareness of the body, then you become aware of feelings. You become aware of the feeling associated with an in-breath, a feeling associated with an out-breath, also pain in the area of the knee, pain in the lower back, various places you might feel pain, itches. You still keep giving the interest to knowing the breath, but you notice feelings, vedana anusati, arising, staying for some time, ceasing. And what else happens? You also have pleasant feelings, rapture, tranquility, coolness in the heart, joy. But then you have a thought come up, oh, I'm worried about such and such, or what shall I do about such and such? But you keep giving the interest to the breath. But the function of sati is it has this capacity to know things more clearly according to their nature, truth-discerning awareness. So the more you keep meditating, you develop a bit of a sense for thinking is just thinking, a thought is just a thought, but you also tend to notice that's a wholesome thought, that's an unwholesome thought, that's a skillful thought, that's an unskillful thought. So you're just trying to be aware of your breath, but you get to know your mental habits, you get to know the quality of your thoughts, you develop more of a sense for what should be trusted and what shouldn't be trusted, just while you're trying to be aware of the in-breath and the out-breath. The other thing that you notice is that there's a feeling underneath these things in the area of the heart. All of the hindrances have a feeling component, and this is the citta nupassana. There's the Veda Nusati, a mindfulness of feelings, but also mindfulness of mind states. And what else do you notice? I'm just trying to be aware of the breath, but you'll notice these things keep changing and keep moving. And so this is really important to notice this. You're trying to be aware of your in-breath, you're being aware of your out-breath, there's a thought. Being aware of your in-breath, being aware of your out-breath, there's feelings in the chest area. Always moving around, always changing, arising and ceasing. Sometimes the feelings are associated with hindrances. Sometimes those feelings are associated with a gamatana, an actual meditation object, I mean, pleasant feelings, more coolness arising as you're consistently with your reflection. More warmth arising as you're consistently with your loving kindness. But you're also noticing changing and ceasing. And if we train ourselves to notice the changing and the ceasing, changing and ceasing, changing and ceasing, then this is when the insight occurs. When the insight occurs, Tanajananan has explained, it's often anicchang. When we see anicchang, impermanence, really clearly, often by focusing on that moment of cessation, changing, cessation of a feeling, cessation of a thought. When we see the anicchang with a lot more clarity, there's a feeling of letting go, and the mind also sees that it's not self and experiences emptiness. Emptiness is the experience, awareness that knows emptiness. Emptiness of what? Emptiness of permanence, emptiness of self. Solid self. And so in doing these kind of intensive retreats that you're doing, this is probably a good number of you may have experienced this in moments. And this is, it's very, very helpful if we can experience this, that when there's a letting go of the habitual grasping, when there's an increase in mindfulness, seeing with more clarity, when there's a resting in a kind of a primordial, pristine clarity, and there's not a sense of self there, there's no suffering. Tanajan talks about temporary liberations, tatanga vimutti, that we keep cultivating these five spiritual powers until we get these insights, till we have these experiences of letting go, till we experience that awareness that knows emptiness of grasping and feels that fullness and coolness. Because when we have those experiences, it's conducive to a very powerful quality of faith. You don't just have faith in the teachings and the concepts anymore. You have faith in your ability to experience what the teachings and the concepts are describing. You have confidence in the fact that these teachings lead you to have the same insights that Anya Kondanya and the five first disciples had, that all of those practitioners who's followed in the footsteps of the Buddha have had. And so we get a lot more chanda, a lot more determination, inspiration to practice more. Because we know if we're consistent and if we keep plodding along, there's going to be these moments of peacefulness, there's going to be these periods of letting go, and we shouldn't be trying to see a kind of an unchanging state of happiness. That's not what it is. A lot of people come with an assumption that Buddhist practice is going to lead to happiness. What we have to notice is the absence of suffering. So if you're practicing a lot and there's a lot of suffering and it's a real struggle, and then there might just be a period, 10, 15 minutes, no suffering. We have to notice that. I say, because Lord Buddha says peacefulness is the highest happiness. And this is what we're aiming for. We have to train the mind to recognize a more subtle, superior quality of well-being and contentment, which is what the absence of hindrances or the periods of collectedness or experience of letting go and seeing the deeper nature of your own mind, of everyone's mind. So we practice consistently, diligently, and we have these experiences and moments, and we should derive great confidence in that, in the Buddha's teachings, in your ability, in the relevance of the practice in this day and age. They're always relevant. To be experienced individually by the wise, apparent here and now, these words that we chant in the chanting, for those who practice. The gates to the deathless are open for those with a mind of faith. And we have to practice until the mind goes through that door. So I've been talking for quite a bit, and I guess I'll just say the practice of pilgrimage is helpful because, as I began the talk saying, it's an inner journey. If we can also have like outer journeys that support the inner journey, that's a really wonderful thing. But if we can't, suppose you're not in a position where you can go on a pilgrimage to the four holy sites, or you can't come and visit your teachers in Asia or wherever they live, then what you're doing now, committing to doing periods of retreat, that is a patipati puja, that's an offering of practice, that is the committing outwardly to the disciplines that lead you inwardly, and this is part of what makes our life a spiritual journey with its spiritual goal. So anyway, I hope that something I may have said may be useful to some of you, and I share this for your reflection. Yesterday I was in Bangkok and there was an earthquake. I'm sure many of you know there was an earthquake in Myanmar, 7.7. But what was experienced in Bangkok was 4.9. And Bangkok is an area where we're not used to experiencing earthquakes. So there's a place where I stay on the 7th floor. A kind student of mine has built a kuti, a rooftop kuti with a walking meditation and a garden, so that when I'm passing through Bangkok, myself and my monk brothers can stay there. And so I was in the room with a close student, and sometimes they're building these very big condominiums around, and when they put down the concrete posts, the ground shakes a little bit when they're putting in the pylons. So I'm thinking, oh, they must be putting in some big pylons. But then then the curtains started kind of swaying like that, and the whole building started, and I'm like, no, that's not a pylon, this is something else. And it was interesting to observe the thought process. The thought process was, this is Bangkok, we don't have earthquakes. The next thought is, this is an earthquake. We are having an earthquake. And my student opened the blind and he's like, oh my God, the crane, it's gonna fall. And I said, close the blind, sit down, Buddho. And I sat down, and 4.9 is not nothing. If you've seen any of the footage, the swimming pools are crashing over, the water was sloshing over the side of the penthouses, and was an interesting thought process, because it's like, okay, so this is a real earthquake. It seems to be quite strong. And then there's a thought, should we go down 7 flights? And it's like, well, I don't want to be in a stairwell if... I'm like, I think I just... And there's a thought, well, will that crane land on us? They're very high. And I just had the thought, well, if we're going to die, I'd rather die calm and being mindful, so I'm just going to sit right here and be with Buddha and see what happens. And fortunately, after 4 minutes, it stopped, and we're okay. And unfortunately, there are injured people, there are fatalities, but our hearts go out to those people, and sharing merit, dedicating merit, and hope that as many as possible can be rescued. But it was an interesting thing to see, and for myself, I was glad to see that. I was glad to see that when faced with the possibility of death, my response was to sit down and observe the breath and recite Buddho. And this is so another thing I offer for your reflection. Ajahn Anand said he didn't want to tell lay people that student because he was worried the lay people might think I was stupid, that I should have tried to escape. He said, because lay people tend to think differently to monks because they often have a wife or a husband or a family or a mortgage, and they've got to survive for the sake of other people. But monks are more willing to be with the moment and go wherever whatever's next. So anyway, whatever happens, we do need to have our refuge of mindfulness in the moment, and a capacity to stay collected, be mindful of what's occurring around us,